Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host, an MD and a medical doctor, and your host for an hour of, well, questions, answers, debate, dialogue, discussions, answers to your emails, all here on Ask Dr. Dawn. So welcome, and don't touch that dial. Before we go any further, let me just say that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. And furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Let's go to some emails. One of the great changes in my life in the last 14 years has been this community presence that develops around email. I have regular people who email me, send me interesting clips, sort of scour what's out there, and send a shout out to Duff and Felton for this one. Cell phones. He nailed accurately the big story of the week, which was a media circus around the idea that this latest report from the World Health Organization's International Agency for Research on Cancer is actually meaningful. Now, we'll be posting the link about this to the website, and I want to just start with recapping it for you. The IARC is an organization that is looking at cancer hazards across the board, and they are like sort of like the Cochrane collaboration. They examine all of the research and they publish a report about, you know, how good do we think the evidence is? You know, is this a watch and pay attention? Is this something that's supportable? And they gave the idea that cell phone use could cause cancer of the brain, a group 2B evidence. 2 space B means that there is some evidence for possible carcinogenicity, but that it's not strong enough. It's based on epidemiologic evidence, and it's either in animals with evidence of cancer and a plausible mechanism, or there's strong epidemiology evidence in humans, but no evidence in animals and or no plausible mechanism. And 2B is that second category. So what we have is some epidemiology, no good evidence in animals, and really no effectively plausible mechanism. We have one study that was published last year in the Journal of the American Medical Association that basically showed that if you use a cell phone for an hour, you can speed up brain activity in the area closest to the brain antenna. And this was brain activity as in glucose consumption. So you could, if you really wanted to reach, say, free radicals and causing DNA damage, and that would also mean, by the way, that thinking hard caused cancer, which I certainly hope doesn't turn out to be the case, because I'm really in trouble if that's the situation. Now, the thing that the media ran away with was this idea that it causes a glioma. And there is one study that showed, this is from 1994, so it's an old study, and it showed that there was a higher incidence in gliomas in people with the highest rate of cell phone use. Now, this is back in 1994, and you know what high rate of cell phone use was? It was 1 hour a day. So how many of you speak on the cell phone for less than 1 hour a day? Take a deep breath. You're fine. The rest of us, I guess we need to worry. Really, it's very, very rare cancer, these gliomas. So we need to take a deep breath because the overall risk is small. Even a 40% increase in a very small risk is still small. My friend Duff pointed out, and I think it is a very, very good point, that if you're going to worry about your cell phone, worry about crashing your car because you're concentrating on your cell phone call or because you're texting while driving. If there's any major public health risk associated with cell phones, it's that. It's the risk of distraction. So let's take a deep breath on this, folks. The obvious risk of your cell phone is not brain cancer. It's brain fog and losing your way either while on the road or even while walking on the street. I've had people who are busy texting step right out in front of me, and I drive a Prius, so I'm quiet. We've all got to use the technology carefully and wisely, and sometimes the technology moves a little bit too fast. A email from Matthew in Brooklyn, New York. I told you we were international. Brooklyn's almost another country. Hi, Dr. Don. I'm a very devoted listener, and I listen to your advice carefully. Answer a general medical question for me. I'm aware of the guidelines that stress the importance of getting at least 6 hours of sleep every night, but I wonder if you have any thoughts on how critical it is to get those 6 hours contiguously. If I sleep, say, 7 hours, but have to get up after the first four to go to the bathroom before going back to bed for three more, am I sleep-deprived because I never got 6 hours at once? Well, the answer to that is not if you get right back to sleep. The body and the sleep cycle is capable of picking up where it left off, but just like certain types of pause buttons on your high-tech, recently acquired digital equipment, after about 5 minutes, that it turns itself off. So you need to get back to sleep probably within 15 minutes to avoid having to start over. And what you're starting over with is the circadian rhythm. More about that in a moment. To pick up on Matthew's question, what if I have to get up and actually go to work after the first 4 hours? I've had jobs that allowed me to sleep in two distinct chunks of 4 hours each for a total of 8 hours a day. But exactly how does that differ in the medical effect from sleeping 8 hours at once? What specifically, if anything, is known about the body's medical need for sleep for certain lengths of time contiguously? Well, in answer to that, Matthew, there's a great deal of research looking at the circadian rhythms. And sleep studies show that in the initial stages of sleep, you drop into theta wave and a deep sleep, and you sort of rest your body. That's the point where you're doing your detoxification. That's where your liver is processing things it didn't get to process during the day while you were eating. That's where your deep muscle relaxation occurs. You become physically paralyzed, and that allows for a kind of rebooting of all of the muscle cells. And if you don't get that rebooting after 3 or 4 days, you start to get body aches and a fibromyalgia-like syndrome. So deep sleep happens first. That's the body's priority. And then towards the 4 hour mark, you start to have longer and longer periods of REM sleep. And REM sleep's where you do your memory reprocessing. It's some sort of organization, pruning, reconsolidation, rewiring. I think of it as a sort of disk defragmentation, if you want to use a computer analogy for this. It speeds up your processing, and it allows for those neural nets to form that trigger when you try to remember something. So it's extremely important, and it tends to happen in the second half of the sleep cycle. Now, we know from sleep studies that if we REM deprive people, they get psychotic after a week or so of REM deprivation, maybe less, depends on the individual. And they start to try to REM sleep while awake. We call that a hallucination, not so good for high-functioning individuals. So if you sleep in 2 4-hour cycles, we also know that the second 4 hours, your body kind of flushes you straight into REM sleep. And I think it would depend a lot on what the job was, whether this was something that was sustainable. Long-term, sleeping in 2 4-hour segments is probably quite stressful and destructive to both your immunity and to your cognitive functioning. And we have lots of research on shift workers that show that the more rapidly you shift back and forth from sleeping at night to sleeping in the daytime, the poorer your performance is. So we really do need to reconstruct and reframe work space so that we don't do that to people, assuming we want high-functioning workers. So our next email is from Anonymous in New Jersey regarding a calcium deposit in the shoulder. I'm a 57-year-old woman. I have pain in my right shoulder, and an MRI showed a 1.1 centimeter, I love MRIs, they're so precise and so meaningless, a 1.1 centimeter calcium deposit in my shoulder. The doctor says the only option is to have surgery to remove it and then do physical therapy. Is surgery the only option? If so, are there certain things I should look for when choosing a surgeon? By the way, I have hypertension and type 2 diabetes. I take medication for both. Are there certain precautions I should take for surgery? Oh, this is a great question for so many reasons. So first of all, Anonymous in New Jersey, let me just say that it's not even definite that the calcium deposit is why you have pain. It's sort of things like, we don't do MRIs on shoulders of people unless they have pain. So you kind of take the MRI, you put it up on the board, you show it to the patient, you say, see that thing there? That's not supposed to be there. That's why you have pain. That's a rebuttable presumption. Diabetics frequently have shoulder pain without having a big lump of calcium in their shoulder. Diabetics are prone to something called inflammation, and the shoulders in middle-aged individuals are very prone to inflammation. That's just the way it is. So they get a double helping of inflammation, and there are lots of things that can help with that. Strengthening the muscles between your shoulder blades, called the rhomboids, not slouching at your desk, not resting your elbows on the desk when you're working, making sure that you do overhead exercises so that you keep your flexibility. All of these things are helpful. Once a person gets into trouble with their shoulder, a course of steroid injections and physical therapy should also be always be done before surgery. I completely disagree with the doctor who's telling you surgery is your only option. I bet if he had a different vantage point in the economic system, he might have a different attitude about conservative management. As far as if you decide to go forward with surgery, what should you look for? Well, the first thing you look for is experience. Never have surgery in July in a teaching hospital, okay? Just unless you are dying. But elective surgery in July or August at a teaching facility means that somebody is learning their craft on you. And that's fine. We have to learn, but we should learn on the people who are desperate and therefore have a risk-benefit ratio that favors being operated on right away. And it's their bad luck. It's in July. If you're not in a teaching hospital, it's less of an issue, but you want to be sure that your doctor does at least 50 cases a year of whatever the surgery is. Lots of studies looking at surgical competence have shown that if you're doing 50 cases a year, and it probably should be a case a week rather than 50 and then nothing for 12 months, but the studies didn't break it out that well. That's where you keep your competency and your error rate and your complication rate stays low. If the surgeon's only doing a few of these or you're in the first 50, he's still learning on you. If you do a new procedure that's only been around for a while, chances are the doctor is learning on you. Now, if your need for the new procedure is much greater, hey, that's cool. You need it. You do it. Risk-benefit ratio applies. But when you talk about elective surgery, if you haven't done conservative, I would stall. Other things to do before surgery, stop taking aspirin for about 2 weeks. Stop taking fish oil, St. John's wort, and non-steroidals for at least a week. All of these things increase bleeding. You don't want to increase your bleeding. You can look it up. There are other herbs that increase bleeding. Also, you're going to have pain pills. This is true for everybody out there. If your doctor puts you on narcotics, please take a stool softener every time you take the narcotic, because you will avoid the most common complication of narcotic use, which is not addiction, it's constipation. And believe me, bad constipation is something that can actually put you in the hospital. So you don't want to go there. We're going to go to Mary in Carmel. Hello, Mary. Welcome to the program.
About the 1st of October, I got shingles.
Uh-huh.
I'm 74.
Yes.
I got shingles out of the blue. It lasted, the usual thing that was on my side going around to the front, not my back, on my left side.
I'm sorry, did you say this was your age, 74, or it was in 19?
No, my age is 74.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
And I couldn't take the shingles shot because I have an autoimmune situation and you can't take live virus. Anyway, I got it. Now I'm left with post-herpetic neuralgia.
How far out from your shingles episode are you?
October 1st.
Okay. So more than 6 months, so you've really got it.
I do.
And you really do. Where?
Well, it's on my left side, right where my bra...
Torso. Okay, good.
Torso, and it goes around to the front of my left breast and around my back and up to my spine.
Okay. Yeah, you've got the zebra stripe, basically.
Yeah, right.
All right.
And I just wondered if you had any miracle ideas of how to prevent the pain.
Of course I do.
I knew you would. I count on you, Dr. Don.
Of course I do. Okay, this is something I just learned about from my friend Ray over at Loudon Pharmacy. And he sent me this little flyer, and I thought, okay, it's marketing, but what the heck, I'll give it a try. These are topical creams that contain these really high-level anesthetics like ketamine and lidocaine. Lidocaine is what I would use if I was going to stitch up a laceration on your foot. I'd put a little lidocaine in around with the needle. That's what the dentists use basically when they're pulling a tooth. So it's a really good painkiller. But the problem is you can't take it orally. It's given IV sometimes, used to be for controlling cardiac arrhythmias, but it's never really been able to be used for pain in the ambulatory population until someone came up with these creams, which actually penetrate. And so there are a number of different recipes, and your doctor can get this from any compounding pharmacy locally. There's a compounding pharmacy in Pacific Grove.
Yes, there is.
And they would have this information. And your doctor can write the prescription. And basically, the one I've been using that I find most helpful has ketamine, which is an old general anesthetic.
How do you spell that?
K-E-T-A. Uh-huh. And lidocaine.
And it has lidocaine in it.
And it has lidocaine in it, and you rub it on your skin. And it penetrates deeply enough to kill the nerve endings in the skin. Not kill them, but zonk them so that they don't send any pain signal.
Well, that's good. And is this lidocaine addition a new addition to ketamine?
It's a combination of lidocaine, ketamine, and there's one other ingredient, which off the top of my head I can't remember. And there are about 5 or 6 different formulas, but there are 2 that are specifically recommended for post-herpetic neuralgia, and they work.
Okay.
So at this point, I don't have it in my brain. I pull out my little sheet and look at it and write the prescription.
Oh.
So we'll call the compounding pharmacies and tell them that you want them to send this information to your doctor, tell your doctor to expect it, and that you want to try it.
Okay.
There are also very expensive patches that you can buy from pharmaceutical corporations that accomplish the same thing.
Okay. Well, I've been using something called Purtec. Have you heard of it? P-U-R?
No, I haven't. What is it?
It's a cream. It's a cream. It's a prescription cream.
Okay.
It's called Biofine, and then the generic thing is, it's called Purtec, P-R-U-T-E-C-T.
If it's not doing the trick for you, then I would definitely try these other things.
All right. I did try ketamine, but it didn't have these other things in it.
Yeah, it needs to be the combo, I think, and I would go through all of the different combos because it does vary.
Okay,
all right.
I'll try that.
The other thing I want to throw out there is I've mainly done it on face because you can't use this stuff on your face because you might get it into your eye, but I've had a lot of good effect with acupuncture for resetting the nerves in the spinal column, and the technique is called Craig, C-R-A-I-G, and then capital letters P-E-N-S. And you can look that up. It's actually a trademarked protocol, and it's online. You can find out about it. You can take the information to your local acupuncturist. You don't have to make the pilgrimage up to me in Santa Cruz. You can actually probably find someone locally down there who will work with you on that.
And it's called Craig
Pens. Uh-huh. Percutaneous electrical nerve stimulation. That's why they abbreviated it.
All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Don.
Thank you very much. And
I'll
keep listening.
It.
Okay, good.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And let's go now to Helene in Corralitos. Hello, Colleen. Welcome to
Hello.
Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Dr. Don. My father is 91 years old, and he's in Pennsylvania. I'm a long-distance caregiver. So he had a 4-day hospitalization, and now he's home, and the caregiver says his back end, it's not a bed sore, but it's real red and sore. It's kind of like, she said, like peely skin, like it's very thin, like almost like after sunburn. So what kind of, should we use Desitin or what should we do? What should we do to help to get that skin grow back or get thicker or condition the skin so he doesn't get a bed sore?
Okay, well, it's very, very important to pad the bed. Try to get him to lie on his side. Wherever it is, you want to try to keep pressure off of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because what it needs is oxygen. It really needs oxygen and blood to get to the area. And when you're sitting or pushing against skin, it doesn't fill. Think of a sponge, right? If you've got a sponge full of water and you push on it, you squeeze some of the water out. Well, if that water is life-giving blood with oxygen in it, that skin doesn't have what it needs to rebuild.
And but we have it positioned on the side, so yeah, we do have that.
Good. And there's really lots and lots of creams out there. There's lots of things that are designed for bed sores. Once the skin breaks down, Granulex and things like that. Right now, you don't have a broken down skin. Just a thick coating of like Eucerin cream, Desitin, one of the zinc oxide creams, if Desitin would work, if it's in an area where there is going to be poop or pee getting in contact with it. The problem with the zinc oxide creams, as anyone who's ever had a baby knows, is they're kind of hard to clean off.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to use a lot of friction to clean them off. So something that's designed for elderly skin, Sween cream, that's S-W-E-E-N, is another good one.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that I'll get lots of people calling in now saying, okay, well, this is one that really works, or I'm a home care provider and this one really works. And there are lots of creams and lots of testimonials for them.
Any other light type of tapping or anything I've heard to kind of get blood to that area? Or what do you think, anything else to kind of try to encourage blood and oxygen to that area?
I take it he's completely bedbound. He's non-ambulatory.
No. Daddy's ambulatory, but he's with a walker. However, since he was in the hospital 4 days, what happens is that he was in the bed for 4 days and they really didn't turn him or do any type of PT while he was in there, so he lost a lot of strength.
Right.
He's very weak right now.
Well, of course, obviously you're going to help his strength by encouraging him to walk, the care provider working with him, getting him up. In fact, something that's often neglected, and I want to emphasize that this needs to be done safely, but if you just have the person, instead of getting them up and having them walk, that's good to do, but also what's really good to do is have them get up and get back down and get up and get back down. And just because you're building exactly the muscles that have gotten really weak, which are the hip extensors.
Oh, that's good. Okay.
So, and that's very safe. You know, you can, he can be sitting watching the TV, and every time there's a commercial, he can plant the walker and stand up, sit down, stand up, sit down, and do that for the 5 minutes that the commercial is on. He doesn't need to tire himself out quite as much, but he'll be building those muscles.
Good idea. Thank you.
Yeah. And increasing blood flow, not massaging directly on it, but massaging around it is probably a good idea.
Okay.
Anything that'll increase blood flow. A lot of times I'll actually use acupuncture to increase blood flow. You can direct blood into an area by doing what's called a yang treatment, where you essentially call the blood to the area. It works well. You can watch the skin flush right up. So if there's an acupuncture provider around in your area who makes house calls, you could consider that.
Okay,
or if he's ambulatory going out there.
Okay, very, very good. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Dawn. I appreciate it.
Good luck. And also on the matter of the long-distance provider issue, what is your long-term plan there? Do you have you made alliances with local people around his house?
Oh, I have. I'm actually coordinating 5 caregivers that go in and out round the clock over there. So, yeah, so I have a lot of, well, I have relationship back there, but it's not like having daddy right down the street.
No. Once he's better, though, I just have a specific suggestion. Once he's better, what I would suggest is, because you're going to pull those providers as he improves, right? Or you're going to keep that going?
No, he can't stay by himself now. So the provider's going to be there.
Okay.
Except for at nighttime when he's asleep at this point. So, yeah, but we do have some long-term options.
Are there neighbors or church people that you can use to kind of surveil the situation and make sure you're getting accurate reports from your providers?
Not really.
Okay. Think about when next time you visit, going to the lady across the street or the people across the street and just, you know, handing out your card and saying, if you see anything fishy or if there's no car there when there should be a car there, you know, you give me a call.
Okay, that sounds good. Thank you.
It's in the spirit of trust but verify.
Yeah, it's hard.
It is hard. And having an alliance with the people around locally who are physically there and who aren't working for you and have no vested interest in, except that they're neighbors. You know, we don't make use of our own community resources as much as we should. And of the 3 people living around him, you know, across the street and on either side, one of them will have an elderly parent and is in the same boat, except their parents in Arizona. And they're going to have sympathy. Okay, so see if you
can
get some local resources going, too.
Thank you, Dr. Dawn. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Have a wonderful day. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
Let's do something about that E. coli scare going on in Germany. They had like this real overreaction. It's a lovely case of the domino effect. So far, 16 people have died in Germany, 15 in Germany and a Swede who visited there recently. They all got hemolytic uremic syndrome, which is where your blood vessels start breaking down from a toxin produced by the E. coli. And that blood clogs up the kidneys and puts you into kidney failure, which is, of course, a very, very dangerous condition. It can lead to seizures, strokes, comas, very serious. So it's a big deal when an E. coli gets loose in the food supply, and it would appear that this is in one of the salad vegetables. At least the Germans have been able to identify that all of the identified cases have had tomatoes, cucumbers, and or lettuce. Initially, a story got out that it was Spanish cucumbers, and there's always a little xenophobia within the EU. Right now, Spain is enjoying an absolute collapse of their export agriculture as a result of a probably false charge that their cucumbers were the source of the contamination. You know, it's always those foreign cucumbers that are coming in insidiously, polluting our bodily fluids. Actually, it may have been homegrown German cucumbers for all anybody knows. But all of the E. coli produce Shiga toxin. all of the E. coli which cause hemolytic uremic syndrome produce a toxin called shigatoxin. We had this with the omega-157. Periodically, we have outbreaks in the United States. It's a very similar bug. It really doesn't matter what the bug is. The best way to contain these outbreaks is to be a locavore. It's the foods that are distributed and shipped widely that tend to have more of a problem with contamination. That may have to do with methods of shipping or actually, ironically, the methods of cleaning food in an industrial setting. Bottom line here is that the further your food has been shipped, the more likely it is to be contaminated. At least that's what we see here in the United States. In Germany, they're looking at a different issue. They are definitely overreacting. And I want to emphasize that nobody gets out of here alive. Everybody will eventually succumb to some sort of an illness. And I think that news stories that get hysterical over outbreaks like this do a great deal of harm. And I want, when next time one of these happens, please take a deep breath. Don't overreact. For some reason, the media just loves to whip us into a frenzy, I guess because it sells advertising or gets clicks or gets views. And we have to watch how that affects our perception of the world. So speaking with a request for calmness everywhere, this is Dr. Dawn Motyka. Another news this week, and I'm liking this, okay? It's sort of, I've got little munchkins dancing around singing, ding dong, the witch is dead. And I have a headline for you. Food pyramid collapses under its own weight. Yes, today the FDA, the DEFDA, put out a new food pyramid. It's actually a food plate. If you like Campbellian, Joseph Campbell kind of imagery, what's happened is that the circle, the eternal feminine, has replaced the pyramid, the eternal male, as the way we should be eating. Anyway, the idea is that if you take a look at food portions and you visualize two circles, a big circle and a little circle, the little circle is your one day serving of dairy, and the big circle is your fruits, vegetables, grains, and proteins. So half of that plate is fruit and vegetables, and a quarter of the plate is grains, and a little less than a quarter of the plate is protein. If you eat in that proportionality, the government says, you will actually be healthy. And for once, I'm in agreement with the FDA. Doesn't happen often, so we need to celebrate. This new choosemyplate.gov, and that's the website if you want to check it out, choosemyplate, one word, .gov, is actually supported by scientific evidence, and it is not a disguised industry infomercial, which the previous pyramids have been. And let's go to an interesting story here that I wasn't sure we would have time for, but I think we do. So let's talk about medical records. I'll just tell you, this is from the Huffington Post, and so it is, by definition, an opinion piece. It is written by Fred Schulte and Emma Schwartz, and it's called Electronic Medical Record Shifts: Signs of Harm Emerge as Doctors Move from Paper. Let me just tell you a personal story here. 21 years ago, well, I graduated medical school in 1987. Obviously, I was a medical student before that. But in 1987, I came out. All of the records were on paper. When we wrote orders, we wrote them on that kind of triplicate paper, carbonless carbon paper, basically. You know how degraded the third or fourth copy of that thing is. Well, that's what the nurses had to try to figure out what to do. And so it was difficult for the nurses to know whether Dr. so-and-so wrote for drug A or drug B, and if Dr. so-and-so was tired and it was 2 a.m. and their handwriting was crappy, mistakes would be made. Digitalis might be switched for Dilantin, which is a seizure medication versus a heart medication, because some people's handwriting was that bad. And this was a horrible thing. It was medical errors all over the place. So you can hear the kind of music like the Choir of Angels now as I start to speak about the electronic medical record, which promised clear orders with clarity of writing and no more problems with getting the drug wrong. And it was sounded so good, and everybody bought into it. And recently there has been an additional nudge, which is federal stimulus money. Between now and 2014, if you adopt an electronic medical record, you get extra money from the stimulus package to help you pay for the cost. Not enough to defray it entirely, but it's definitely money on the table. And then after 2014, you actually start to be penalized if you aren't meeting the goals or benchmarks for electronic medical record conversion. Now, this is on its face very good, but what's happened is industry has jumped into the fray, and some of the software that is out there being purchased by major hospital groups has gotchas and errors and is just badly designed. What is it with healthcare? Okay, you get the end user not being the purchaser. If I buy, let's say, a photo software program and I don't like it, I don't buy the upgrade. I go buy a different program and you vote with your feet. Well, what if I couldn't buy the program? What if the county of Santa Cruz decreed that all of the photo processing software in our county would be this brand? Well, obviously, there'd be a lot of lobbying for the people who are making that decision by the various photo companies and lots of nice dinners and things. And eventually they'd make a decision and we'd all be stuck with the results of that decision. And so large hospital corporations choose what medical software to buy, and then they farm it out to all of their hospitals. And they basically tell them, use it or you're fired. And this is not a really good way to get people to adopt an electronic medical record, but it's pretty much how it's being done. And unfortunately, many of the computerized provider order entry programs are not very good. They make it easy to make different kinds of medical errors. So instead of bad handwriting, which at least you know you can't read the handwriting and have to go verify it, what you have is an order that looks perfectly fine. It looks like an appropriate order. It looks like the doctor meant it and you can read it. But it may be entirely the wrong drug because the interface uses a pull-down window. And when you try to click with your mouse on one drug because the next drug down is so close, you end up clicking on the wrong drug. There's an easy one to make. Here's another one. All of these programs default to the time to start the drug. So if you write a drug for, let's say, an antibiotic for a patient in the emergency room, and you're not very careful, and it's after a certain time, which is not published on the order as you're doing it, that drug may not be given until the following day because the default start time is put in by the computer. And it's easy to miss. Things like that should be hard to miss. Things like that should be like big box. Do you really want to erase this file? Do you remember when you could easily lose data because you could hit close and it would cancel and you would lose all your data? And now the people who software you didn't buy again because it would do that to you have basically put big old things. Are you sure you want to erase this file? And you have to click on it. Well, how about, are you sure that you want to order this life-saving antibiotic tomorrow morning and not right now? Because most people who chose to order life-saving antibiotics wanted them started immediately. You know, why don't they write it that way? Believe me, they've gotten tons of feedback. These big companies just don't listen. They don't have to respond to the end user. They have to respond to the big hospital corporation. So is there a problem here with electronic medical records? Absolutely. Are the people in the Huffington Post with this investigative article making a good point? Absolutely. Do we need to insist that the end user be able to alter the electronic medical records parameters when they identify a error that could potentially endanger patients? Absolutely. Are we doing it? No. So that was my editorial for the day. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope that you have enjoyed this program. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.